lines. Given that, HBCUs have been facing increasing challenges. Their enrollment has been falling as competition for students has risen. Some fear historically black colleges and universities are becoming an anachronism, but not our guests today. They believe these schools have something to offer that is unique and valuable, and we invited them to join us to expand on that and their vision for historically black colleges and universities heading into the future. Dr. Philip Clay is professor of city planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the author of Historically Black Colleges and Universities Facing the Future, and he joins us from the studio at MIT. Dr. Clay, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. In our studios, Dr. Alfred Anthony Pinkard, the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer for Administrative and Academic Management at Johnson C. Smith University. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
And joining us by phone, Elwood Robinson, just months into his tenure as Chancellor of Winston-Salem State University. I believe, if I'm correct, you started there as Chancellor in January. Is that right?
That's correct, Mike. I started January 1.
So how's it going?
It's going well. I mean, I think it has exceeded my expectations. I knew I was coming to a great university. Nothing has changed since I've been here for the past 4 months.
Well, that's good to hear. Before we start and get into the challenges and the aspirations for the future, let's define what we're talking about. There's got to be a definition of historically black colleges and universities. And since you're sitting here in front of me, Dr. Pinkard, tell me what that definition
is.
Well,
actually, it's a term that was defined by the Higher Education Act of 1965, and HBCUs were defined as those institutions that were formed prior to 1964 that were established expressly for the education of people of African descent or African Americans.
And are there new colleges coming into that fold, or are they limited to a certain number that were established before a certain
date?
Well,
presently there are about 105, 106 HBCUs. There are two that are historically black but are no longer predominantly black. For example, West Virginia University has a predominantly white population, and it is historically black in terms of its designation. And Bluefield State University also is predominantly white in terms of its student population.
When these colleges were established, by whom were they established, and where did the funding come from? Because some of these date right to the end of the Civil War. You wrote the book about this. So Dr. Clay, give us a little history lesson here.
Many of these institutions were created in the years immediately following the Civil War, starting as early as 1865 or 64 and through the 1870s and 1880s. A few of them were established later. These were mainly the public institutions that were created as a part of the actions on the part of several states in the South mainly. To open up opportunities for black students. Some of them were liberal arts, but most of the liberal arts schools were primarily teacher education institutions. North Carolina Central is one of the oldest. I think its first name was North Carolina Normal School, meaning aimed to prepare teachers. Others were set up as agricultural and mechanical and other kinds of what we would today call STEM institutions. North Carolina A&T is in that tradition.
And Elwood Robinson, you went to a historically black college, and now you run one. Talk about the two schools, the one you went to and the one you run. What were their niches at the time, and what is their niche today?
Well, I think at the time, when coming from, grew up in rural North Carolina, tried to find a place that would give me a quality education, and that's why I ended up going to North Carolina Central. They had a great liberal arts tradition. I was interested in majoring in psychology, and they gave me that opportunity. But it gave me that opportunity within the context, I think, of a caring environment, a supportive environment, and an environment that really embraced me for who I was. And I think that was what was important for me at that particular time. Mm-hmm. As I transitioned as a student and then going into professorship and then an administrator, I knew that's the kind of institution I wanted to be a part of. And if I ever got a chance to lead one, that was going to be the focus of how I wanted to lead that institution. And so coming to Winston-Salem State University was an opportunity for me to continue that tradition of high-quality education within the context of a caring environment and one which was supportive of students and trying to help them maximize their full potential.
Now, I can't see you, Mr. Robinson, and I can't see Dr. Clay. He's at MIT. I can only see Dr. Pinkert here, and I know that I'm just going to assume, I'm going to make a leap of faith here and think that you're all well out of your 30s.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. You're so kind.
You're absolutely correct.
We really appreciate
well
that.
Out of our 30s. Well, let me speak for me. I'm well out of my 30s.
I've been 39 many times.
Yeah. The reason I even bring that up is because all of you have seen a major transition, a major
absolutely.
Shift in how these colleges purpose themselves within the community at large and within the African-American community, because when you went to school, you probably didn't have many options. You gravitated toward these institutions because that was what was available.
Actually, that's not my story.
Okay.
When I graduated from high school, I had, in fact, a couple of options and turned down a scholarship at the University of Notre Dame to go to Morehouse College in Atlanta.
Why
and
did
that
you
was
make
purposeful.
That decision?
Because I had attended private schools my entire life, and my entire life I was in the minority. And so as a 12th grader, the idea of going to a place where I would no longer be a minority was very appealing to me. So that had I gone to the University of Notre Dame, that would have been a continuation of my educational experience. And I wanted something different. Hmm. And so in my case, it was a purposeful an intentional decision. And we think that at JCSU, we see those same kinds of stories. Students who have an option to go elsewhere, who choose to come to, in our case, a private HBCU. And I think that's part of the narrative that's sort of lost, this notion that HBCUs exist because students can't go anyplace else. But we like to think that HBCUs are part of the really unique mosaic of American higher education.
Well, today they can go.
But could I add a word on that?
Sure.
The point that these institutions exist because the students cannot attend other schools is an important narrative to attack. If I had a son or daughter who wanted to be a physician or a scientist, they would have many choices for sure. But I would certainly have to consider Xavier University, an HBCU in New Orleans, because it has one of the best records of preparing young black men and women to enter medical school and science PhD programs. And that is a record which is demonstrated in terms of the success of its graduates and in terms of the continuing parade of admissions deans who go there to look for students that they know exist there that are prepared at that institution. Now, whether these students could have done well at other institutions is not a doubt, but they find that Xavier provides the kind of encouragement which I suspect, in which I know they wouldn't get at many other institutions, but is reliably available at Xavier. And other schools will have their own ways of showing a special excellence and niche.
We're going to talk about that as we go through the program. I'd like you to talk about the impact that these schools have had for 150-plus years on the community at large and on the African-American community, because without these schools, at least in the earlier years, these kids would not have gotten an education. These people would not have gotten an
Absolutely.
Education.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what has been the impact historically?
I think it's been just an amazing impact on this nation and an impact on the world. I mean, when you think about HBCUs, I mean, over half, 50% of all the nation's African-American teachers come from HBCUs. And so that's important in terms of just educating teachers. But across the board, they've had a tremendous impact in terms of the economy for many of the regions in which they're located. We've had a tremendous impact in terms of educating folks, particularly at Winston-Salem State University in nursing. We actually graduate about a third. I mean, the third highest graduates in graduating nurses in the state. And so we've had a tremendous impact on this region's economy. And we've done that for over a century.
And Dr. Pinker, you have said that these schools, HBCUs, have directly or indirectly touched the lives of every African American living today.
Absolutely, either as alums themselves or their parents or members of their families have attended these institutions. Because at one point, as you noted earlier in the conversation, HBCUs were the only option for high-performing African American students. So if you consider in the 20s and the 30s and earlier and later, when these very, very well-prepared high school students were looking for a collegiate education, they had only HBCUs to consider. They then became educated, entered the educated workforce, and oftentimes their children would have attended HBCUs or not. And so most African Americans today can tell you of a personal history of someone that they know, either immediately or not so immediately.
Is that a subconscious realization, or is it readily recognized within the African-American community?
I think it's fairly regularly recognized. I mean, even when I engage my contemporaries who did not go to HBCUs, they will oftentimes talk about having wanted to go to one, or a family member, oftentimes a parent or maybe a grandparent, who in fact attended an HBCU. Yeah. You certainly see that at Johnson C. Smith.
Elwood Robinson, I think you want to jump in here.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. It's hard to meet anyone, I think, any African-American today in which HBCUs has not touched their lives. And in many ways, they support these institutions as well, and they are committed to their success. And I think that's why the future of HBCUs are bright.
Despite declining enrollment, when the barriers to other schools were lowered and African American students could apply and gain admission to those other universities, obviously they were taking students away from historically black colleges and universities. Did that come as a shock, an unexpected shock to the system, or did you see it coming because of the civil rights movement?
Well, I think that one of the ways that we like to look at this at Johnson C. Smith is, again, we consider HBCUs to be a part of a mosaic of institutions in America, so that you have women's colleges, you have community colleges, you have liberal arts colleges, you have major research institutions, you have urban institutions, you have rural colleges, and all of these provide an option for students coming out of high school who are seeking a collegiate experience. And so you're absolutely right. Early on, when there were other choices for high-performing black students, many of them went to predominantly white institutions, and there was a dip in enrollment. But we also saw those students, and myself, my own personal narrative suggests that there were those students and will continue to be those students who make the choice that they see an HBCU as an option for them, as a part of a number of options. And again, you're absolutely right. Some HBCUs have experienced dwindling enrollments, but not all.
One of the things you can come in just a couple of seconds. We have to take a break. And Dr. Clegg, and I'll let you say whatever you have to say. And when we come back, I also want to talk about the importance of these schools telling their stories, because it's all about marketing today. If you don't tell your story, no one knows what it is, and they can't choose you. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and historic South End Gallery Crawl. This Friday night, celebrating Charlotte's Got Art, the kickoff of South End Art and Soul, starting tomorrow. Details at historicsouthend.com. And Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, making a difference for patients with brain and spine disorders for 75 years. With 45 specialists and 9 offices in the Charlotte and the Triad regions, CNSA.com. Middle East conflicts, the rise of ISIS, the wooing by the Islamic State of young people in the United States and around the world is certainly cause for concern, but not for violence here at home. And recently here in Charlotte, Chapel Hill, and elsewhere around the country, there have been violent incidences some view as hate crimes aimed at Muslims. We sit down with a local Muslim leader, an author, and a visiting scholar to get their perspective on recent events tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Obama administration is pushing for fast-track authority for the TPP an international trade deal, but many Democrats are opposed. Debate over giving the president fast-track authority.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHA. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about historically black colleges and universities, the challenges and the opportunities they face. With us in our studio, Dr. Elford Anthony Pinkard, Executive VP and Chief Operating Officer of Johnson C. Smith University. Dr. Elwood Robinson is joining us by phone. He's the Chancellor of Winston-Salem State University. And Dr. Philip Clay is a professor of city planning at MIT and the author of Historically Black Colleges and Universities Facing the Future. Before I move on to other topics, Dr. Clay, I know you wanted to add to what we were talking about just prior to the break.
Yes, I wanted to build on the comments of Dr. Pinkard. What I want to do is to try to put HBCUs in the context of other types of institutions. They are, for the most part, especially the private ones, in the category called small liberal arts colleges. And as a category, that is a set of institutions that in general faces some very tough challenges, including enrollment, including their niche and what they offer and the message that they extend. So I say this because I don't want the audience to think that HBCUs are some special troubled category. Mm-hmm. They are part of the larger category of institutions facing facing challenges that we call small liberal arts colleges.
In fact,
the public institutions have a different issue, but they still are part of the public institution malaise as well.
WFAE's Lisa Wharf did a piece on historically black colleges and universities. It aired this morning during Morning Edition, and you can hear it on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. But in that piece that she did, you told her that when you build or rebuild a school around ideas of excellence, there's no reason for black students to feel that they will somehow suffer because they go to an HBCU. Dr. Clay, do black students feel that they're going to suffer? Do some black students feel that they're going to suffer? And if so, why?
Well, I think that is a narrative which is which is communicated to them by their parents sometimes or relatives, guidance counselors, and perhaps they pick it up from some parts of the media presentation. I think the choice the students should make is a choice based on the kind of program they seek and the kind of institution in which they can be comfortable and well supported. And certainly HBCUs can be considered in the category of being able to provide students with support and comfort, where I think the challenge is for HBCUs is to make sure that they have a program, a set of options that would be compelling and competitive for students and to get the message out about them.
Yes, telling the story. Let's talk about telling the story of these colleges to convince students not only that they should come here, but the value of the education they will receive. What story is being told right now at Winston-Salem State University, Dr. Robinson?
I think the story that we're telling at Winston-Salem State is really, I think Dr. Pinkard has really framed the narrative very well. We don't see HBCUs as a monolith. I mean, we see HBCUs as a set of colleges that were created prior to 1964 for express purpose of educating African Americans or folks who had been denied. That narrative has changed because we're now looking at becoming a great university. And so we want folks to come to Winston-Salem State University because they will get a high-quality, great education in a caring environment, in a supportive environment. They will get an education that will prepare them for the 21st century. We are about training folks to be able to go out to be good readers and good writers and good thinkers and be professional in their approach to everything they do. We think those are the kinds of qualities that the workforce, the 2020-2030 workforce is looking for in this knowledge-based economy. And so we're telling a different story, and we want folks to know that we're in a great position. Oftentimes, we leave the story to be told by others. I've told my executive team, and I've told people here at Winston-Salem State that we're not going to do that. We're going to tell our own story. And so we have a set of metrics that really clearly tell that we're tell everyone that we're on the right track. So when people start talking about us, we say, just look at the data. Look at what our graduates are doing. We in a state in North Carolina in the UNC system. Our graduates, think about this, at Winston-Salem State, 79.8% of the seniors are employed. That's the highest in the UNC system, which includes universities such as UNC and NC State. But it is WSSU that has the highest rate. And also they make the most money. And so we can't allow other folks to tell the narrative. And I'm sure Dr. Pinkert feels the same way at Johnson C. Smith.
What is the story of Johnson?
Absolutely. Well, we are strategically reimagining ourselves, and that's reflected in our definition as Charlotte's premier new urban institution. Mm-hmm. We are diverse. We're located in a challenging urban community, which helps define what a new urban institution is. We have a student mix of residential and commuter students. It's a liberal arts-based program with career preparation as a part of it. We've just begun a new program, master's program in social work. We are establishing online degree programs in sports management and business administration. We have a very significant diversity initiative. In fact, yesterday and today, we're hosting our first diversity and inclusion summit. We offer passports to every one of our students enrolled to give them a global experience. And we have a STEM building that's about to be completed. We are strong in the STEM, and we're also developing arts along the corridor so that we are very, very excited about our visual performance and communication arts program.
Well, you're doing things with outreach. You're making yourself, you're going beyond the ivy-covered walls and into the community and making some changes within that community. How important is that for not only your school, but for any HBCU or any college for that matter?
Well, it's certainly a part of the historic mission of many HBCUs, that is to be very much a part of the host community in which they find themselves. And if you imagine that early on these communities were challenged economically, then the HBCU then was the place where important information, knowledge generation occurred that would help the community. Even though we have made a lot of strides in all areas, African-American communities still are disproportionately impacted around key variables that impact quality of life. Mm-hmm. And if you have a university where people are gathered and excited about knowledge generation and the life of ideas, then it is incumbent upon that university to help address the challenges of its host community.
Hmm. Dr. Robertson, you've said that HBCUs enroll only 10% of African-American students in this country today while accounting for almost 20% of African-American graduates. Now, there are about 105 of these HBCUs around the country. So if you only have 10% of the African-American student population going to college, I would think that's because there are only 105 colleges. If you had 10,000, that would be a problem. So put those numbers into perspective. 10% of the students, 20% of the graduates.
Well, I mean, what it says is that we're doing a good job with the students that we have. That means we're educating those students. Those students are eventually getting a degree. I mean, time to degree in many of our communities today is much longer than the traditional 4 or 6 years. People stop out, they have to work, they do a variety of things, but in the end, they end up getting their degrees, and so we're very excited about that. So it means that the students that decide to come here are committed to getting a high-quality education, and they go out into the world to make a difference. We were talking about this whole idea of how we educate. We talk here at Winston-Salem State about Winston-Salem State University about the educational experience, and that is not only what happens in the classroom, but what happens outside of the classroom, what we do in our community, what we do with externships and internships, what we do in terms of making sure our students are involved in the community and community service. And as a result of that, when they get out, they tend to work in those communities. If we think about how we're going to educate the next generation of urban teachers or the next generation of folks who are going to go into some of these areas that really need assistance in health care, They typically come from universities such as Winston-Salem State University because of the context in which we give them an education, and that is, you know, enter to learn and to get a high-quality education, mm-hmm. and our motto, depart to serve, go back into the community to make a real difference.
Dr. Clay, you wrote a paper several years ago called Facing the Future, a Fresh Look at Challenges and Opportunities for Historically Black Colleges and Universities, in which you said that HBCUs continue to play a critical role in advancing the race and achieving President Obama's national goals for higher education and economic competitiveness, including a dramatic increase in college completion rates by 2020. Now, many schools are working toward that second goal. I would think that HBCUs might be alone in the role of advancing the race. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, I would follow on Dr. Robinson's comments about the source of key servant leaders in our community. He mentions teachers, but that list could also include other professions, physicians, nurses, and so forth. So the HBCUs have historically played a role in that, and we need to count on their continued contributions to those same areas. None of those areas cease to, you know, all of them are still important. I think that's the main point, which I would repeat.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge, though, is if you ask why the enrollment has come down, part of it is simply that black students have more choices. But I'm troubled by one particular choice, which increasing numbers of students are taking, which to me represents a problem. We know that many of our students are going to community colleges, and that's been an area of fast growth. And none of us would certainly I would not want to criticize that. I think sometimes community colleges would play a critical role and an opportunity for a variety of educational experiences that students need. But I'm especially concerned about many of the for-profit institutions that do not have a record of performance. Their performance is seriously weak in terms of college completion. There's not confidence in the market that the quality of the students is very high. They tend not to focus on developing the students' preparation to serve, as Dr. Robinson pointed out. And so I think that, and of course, the graduation rates are very low, often typically under 20%. Now, that's a problem for me because I think many of these students would have a much better experience, as their forebears had, if they attended an HBCU or if they attended a community college and then an HBCU or any of the other options that students have.
Because are you talking about the under – how can I say this? The underserved population who did not get adequate preparation for college but still want to go? Is that what you're talking about? They'll get a better experience at an HBCU because they – teachers there understand what these kids are facing?
Well, sometimes it's a lack of preparation because, you know, we still have a K-12 problem as well as the access and opportunity and completion problem in college. So many of the students do leave a high school not fully prepared for the challenges of college. So the question is, what's the best place for them to go? And I think community colleges play a role, but I think those students have been the special institution for those students, many of whom enter with limited preparation and graduate competitive with students trained anywhere.
Mike, one of the things.
Sure.
Mike, could I add just a different twist to what Dr. Clay is talking about?
Certainly.
One of the issues that concerns me in terms of students who are coming out of high school is this really stratification of the difference in economics, family dynamics. With students who come from families who make six figures or above, they do extremely well in college. Those who come from families that make less than $50,000 don't do as well. And it has nothing to do with academic ability. It has everything to do with economics. There's been studies that have looked at students who have the exact same profile, but the family income is different. and those students don't do as well. I'm very concerned about those students going to certain universities where they don't have the kind of support and care they deserve. Oftentimes, these are first-generation students, so they go to college, and they don't have anyone to talk to. They don't have anyone to mentor them or anyone to help them navigate the system, and they end up dropping out. And so one of the things that I'm committed to doing is to making sure that those students get the kind of support they need in order for them to be successful in college.
I'd like to sort of amplify on what Dr. Robinson has indicated. We've not talked about the importance of having a young person look at someone who reflects themselves in some kind of way, whether it's a faculty member or an administrator, and have that young person internalize their possibilities as a result of what they see. That's an important part of the collegiate experience, and that's one of the things that that HBCUs provide. It's also one of the things that women's colleges provide for young women. Mm-hmm. Not all young women need that, but many young women need that. That is the idea that I can see someone who has a doctorate. I can see someone who is the college president. I can see someone who is a physicist or a chemist or a biologist. And that person looks like me and may have perhaps had a similar kind of experience.
They did it, so can I.
Absolutely. And that's an important part of this experience. Again, not all African-American students need that, but many do.
And Dr. Robinson, you have referred to HBCUs as being, you set up the analogy differently, but you said they're the warm blanket of college educational experiences.
I hope that's the case. I mean, that's what we try to make sure that we do here at Winston-Salem State University. That's what I'm accustomed to, is going to a place where you are supportive, that people believe that you can excel, and they support that. I mean, some oftentimes we have folks who go to universities and they don't see anyone that looks like themselves. They don't see anything on campus that reflects their culture or their identity, and they have these messages that they can't perform at a very high level. We don't want that to happen here at our institution. Mm. We want folks coming in with a mindset that they can excel to the highest possible level. And we want that to be done in an environment that is caring, but we also want that in an environment that's challenging and preparing them for the next generation.
One of the students that WFAE's Lisa Wharf talked to in the course of putting together this piece that aired this morning on Morning Edition about HBCUs, she talked to a student who said one of the reasons they chose an HBCU was because they wanted to be in an environment where they looked like the other students, where they understood the other students' experience coming in. The other students understood what their struggles had been to get there. My question is, I'll have to hold the question till after the break. My question is, if college is about opening your eyes to new experiences, how important is it to be around others like yourself when you could also be someplace else where you could see differences? We'll come back and get an answer to that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NS2 presenting the Pixies with special guest John Grant Tuesday, May 12th at Ovens Auditorium. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. And the Hickory Museum of Art currently exhibiting From the Master's Hands, Eddie Hamrick Woodwright throughout the summer, hosting a reception for his 40-year retrospective May 9th. Details at HickoryMuseumOfArt.org. The Obama administration is pushing for fast-track authority for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's an international trade deal, but many Democrats are opposed. And on the Diane Rehm Show today in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, they'll be looking at the debate over giving the president fast-track authority. If you'd like to join our conversation, now would be the time. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
Sometimes in radio, it's easiest just to let the tape do the talking for you. So here you go.
Leave some of your common sense at home and actually try something printed or pink or sequined or fun.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, designer clothes straight to your door, a CEO-guided tour of Rent the Runway next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHEI. Mike Collins, we're talking about HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, the challenges they face, the opportunities they present, and for not only for themselves, but for students who go there, and some of the challenges they face in telling their story in a modern world. Dr. Alfred Anthony Pinkard is with us. He's the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Johnson C. Smith University. He's in our studio. Dr. Elwood Robinson is the Chancellor of Winston-Salem State University. He joins us by phone, and Dr. Philip Clay is sitting at a studio at MIT, where he's Professor of City Planning and the author of Historically Black Colleges and Universities Facing the Future. I mentioned just before the break in the piece that ran this morning on Morning Edition by our Lisa Wharf in our news department, that she spoke to one student who wanted to go to a historically black college because she could be around people like herself who understood the struggles she experienced and she and her family experienced to get her to that point where they had a mutually shared experience. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? If college is about expanding your horizons, is it good to cocoon?
Well, I think it's much more nuanced than the question might suggest. For example, we all know that every student that comes to an HBCU comes from an integrated experience. I mean, the world that they live in is integrated. So they have much more multicultural, actually, than others who may not be African American. That's really a part, the interesting irony of the African American experience. When they come to our campuses, there is an assumption that because we are historically black, we are predominantly black or all black, and that is not the case. For example, I would suggest that the faculty and administration at Johnson C. Smith is probably the most diverse of any institution in the area. I may be wrong. I have no empirical data to back that up, but certainly anecdotally. So our students are coming into contact with faculty members who are from China, who are from India, who are from South America. Also at JCSU, as I've mentioned earlier, we have a very strong diversity initiative. So students will meet students from Haiti, from South Africa, from Mexico, from Venezuela. So there is much more of a multicultural and diverse experience. However, what the student was saying, I suspect, was that the idea that many of the people that she would see who are in powerful, influential positions who look like her would experience, would understand her experience. And that for her was comforting. I might also suggest that what she was saying was that the issue of race, the burden of race, some sociologists might suggest, is not as acute in this environment because you are with others.
You let your guard down.
Absolutely. And we don't talk about this enough, but presently at many predominantly white colleges and universities, we're seeing an uptick of what one might call really racist experiences by students. I mean, we get a catalog of what's going on at these institutions. And so prospective students are seeing that as well. They're seeing that someone's burning a cross at the Harambe House, or someone has driven
singing
by
racist songs on buses.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so this is becoming much more of the current narrative in higher ed.
Well, on the other hand, one of the other students at least spoke to, I don't know where she goes to school, but she says, and this is a quote, honestly, my black friends say they don't want to go to an HBCU because there are too many black people. Unfortunately, it's been stereotyped and assigned to black people that we're loud and ghetto and ratchet, which everyone is all of those things at some point in time. I guess they feel it wouldn't be a good environment for them as a result. I mean, if that came from a white person, that would be insulting, but this came from an African-American student.
Yeah, well, again, that's another show, quite frankly,
right.
That looks that looks at the psychosocial, emotional experiences or consequences of the African-American experience. And so because you have African-Americans who themselves harbor anti-African-American feelings, or they themselves have been impacted by the very same stereotypes that the larger culture. I mean, we all grow up in this culture.
That's so right.
All of those stereotypes that you may have heard about Black people, I heard them as well.
Right.
And if no one was in my life mitigating what I was hearing, then what happens at the end is what you have in terms of that particular student's comment.
Let's flip the coin, because I understand that 40% of the students at HBCUs on average are not African American. Why do those students choose to come to an HBCU, do you think?
One of the things that I want to say here, and I think this is an excellent opportunity to talk about what I talk about with the TED Talk, and that is the HBCU experience. See, I think the HBCU experience is something that everybody wants. It is one in which you are valued for your individuality, you are valued for your culture, you value for who you are, and everything that we do affirms that when you come on campus. And so as we become more diverse, and I think HBCUs are some of the more diverse campuses, both from a faculty standpoint and also from a student standpoint. Here at Winston-Salem State University, we have a large percentage of Caucasian students. We have a growing Hispanic population and Latino. We even have a growing Asian population, which was a very quick, interesting story was when I did my TED Talk on campus, I had a contingent of Asian students who were there. And I talk about the HBCU experience. And after the show, I mean, they came up and talked about how welcome they felt and how much they had learned and what the perception that they had about an HBCU had been changed because of their own experience. And so for me, it's about creating that kind of experience that anyone would want to come to.
Go ahead, Dr. Corey.
Let me just remind everybody that when we ask where do students, what's the racial experience of college students, there are an awful lot of Black students, as Dr. Pinkard mentioned, who come from desegregated backgrounds. And there are many white students who come from backgrounds that are both. So the question I would put to us, an 18-year-old or their parents, would be, what's the experience? What kind of environment does the student want to have in their college-going experience? And there are some students who benefit from, and they're not just Black students, who benefit from an environment which focuses on the experience of the Black population, including all of the things from history to coping with the world as it is evolving. And I think that's an important thing to protect and make part of the future narrative.
I think one of the things that all three of you have spoken about, and I think Dr. Clay, you've pointed this out in something you've written, if I remember correctly. You've all talked about mentorship. You've all talked about helping students who may be not well prepared for college, but even those who are well prepared, mentoring them so that they can excel and graduate from a school of excellence and with an excellent experience. How do you do that with students? Because all colleges have too few teachers and too many students. How do you mentor these kids, particularly those that come not as well prepared as others and who need the help, but ultimately you turn out people who are on par with everybody else? How do you do it?
Well, you do it in two ways. First of all, you have very well-established academic support programs, so that these are programs on campus that are established to provide the kind of support for students who may need it. And then there is an informal network. You, as an administrator or as a faculty member, you see students that you're drawn to, they're drawn to you. You begin conversations. Before you know it, they're visiting your office. You begin to talk about a number of things. So it's both formal and informal. At JCSU, for example, we have the Biddle Institute, and that's an established program, especially for those students who come to us that have indicated that they have some aptitude for college work. They may not have all of the expected credentials, but somehow they have they've expressed a desire, and we have a program for them. We provide wraparound services. We also have the Foster Village Network. We take students who have aged out of foster care. That's a particular program that we're very excited about. So again, as I'm sure Dr. Robinson would indicate, you do it in a number of ways, but certainly you must have established programs in place.
And Dr. Robinson, you talk about the mission of your school, Winston-Salem State University, aside from education, obviously, is service and justice. Mm. Talk about that mission, because the service mission seems to be a thread that runs through many, if not all, of these historically black colleges and universities.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think it was certainly part of the ethos in which they were founded. And we talk about service and we talk about social justice, and that is doing the right thing and also doing things to make sure that we create a better world. And that, whether that has to do with education or the environment or business ethics or medical ethics, it is about understanding that you are part of a larger equation and that the work that you do has impact on humanity. And I know that's broad-based, but it is kind of how we want our students when they leave WSSU to kind of think about that, going into the world to serve, going into the world with a huge sense of social justice and mission. And most of our programs are centered around that concept and that idea.
Is that something that resonates with young people and their parents today? Because we've had these conversations on this program and throughout the country about the purpose of a college education. Governor McCrory recently said something along the lines of, I want to make sure that colleges prepare people for jobs of the 21st century. If you want to do something, I'm paraphrasing here, want to do something that's intellectually stimulating and it doesn't lead to a job, I'm not really interested in that. So is that something that you're shuddering over there?
Absolutely. Because
I'm very discouraged, disappointed
we
at
all
that
are.
Statement.
I think Dr. Clay, we all are.
One.
Yeah, we all are. And that's really a part of a kind of anti-intellectual stream in American culture that has persisted, and we're schizophrenic about it. We recognize that a college education is important, and we espouse that for certain populations. You know, there's a certain segment of this nation, they're not questioning the purpose of education. So it's always curious to me of a college education.
Yeah.
So it's always curious to me when that conversation is directed at a particular population. Now, to your question, admittedly, most parents come to us and they say, we want our child to be able to earn a living. And we say we can do that, but we can also broaden their perspective and give them the kinds of tools that would allow them to appreciate a life well lived. And we think that that's the importance of liberal arts education. Dr. Clay mentioned earlier that liberal arts colleges are really under fire because of comments like our governor's. Mm-hmm. And so the Council for Independent Colleges, for example, the association that represents liberal arts colleges, they have initiated an entire campaign to really sort of say to the public, a liberal arts education is important. It's important, but it will also position you to get a good job as well.
President Obama recently announced a push to get free community college tuition so that more people could go to college, lowering the cost of a four-year education, go to community college free for 2 years, then go off to college somewhere. If he's successful at that and makes that happen, how does that impact your colleges, historically black colleges?
Well, for us, and I certainly would like to hear from Dr. Robinson and Dr. Clay, for us at Johnson C. Smith, that would be an exciting opportunity because we could establish articulation agreements. One of the things that and Dr. Clay references much earlier in the discussion, we see a lot of African-American and Hispanic students going to community colleges. What we don't see, and this is a little bit troubling, again, like Dr. Clay, this is not to disparage those institutions at all. They're an important segment of American higher education. But oftentimes, black students and Hispanic students will not finish at a community college, whereas their white counterparts will take advantage of articulation agreements and go on to complete a baccalaureate and sometimes advanced degrees. And so to the extent that we can partner with these institutions to make sure that students come in, take the 2 years of community college, and if they're interested in pursuing a degree further, they might be able to come to an HBCU.
But if one of the features of an HBCU is to provide a nurturing environment, a mentorship environment for students who have not been well prepared, but they can get that now free if he's successful at a community college. Doesn't that take revenue away from you and an opportunity to work with these students for two extra years? I'm not sure who should answer that question.
I'm not sure the arithmetic of this, but right. I think any program, and I think the president's proposal is one, any program that will boost the success that students have in approaching college will be good for all of higher education.
Absolutely.
And I think that if students go to a community college and get a good preparation, not be burdened by debt, and they're able to complete that program, then they would be a real asset to HBCUs and any other institution that would extend a hand to those students. I see nothing but good from it.
I have about 30 seconds left, Dr. Clay, and you say that nurturing students in the 21st century may look quite different from the 20th century style of engagement with students. If you can do it in 30 seconds, explain that.
Well, I think black students today and lots of other students as well come from a more complicated world than they came in 1870.
Mm-hmm.
There are students who come to college or come to the college period ill-prepared. There are others who come beaten down and having little self-confidence. And I think the HBCU has historically been a very good opportunity for those students to get on the right path so that they can absorb the academic material.
And all of you are optimistic about the future of these schools. It's interesting to note that North Carolina, I believe, has more students enrolled in HBCUs than any other state. Dr. Alfred Anthony Pinkert, Johnson C. Smith, Dr. Elwood Robinson, Winston-Salem State University, and Dr. Philip Clay joined us from MIT. Thank you all for the honor.
Thank you so
Charlotte
much.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and communities in schools investing in Charlotte's future by bringing together corporate, faith, and community partners to help students be successful in school and in life. Details at cischarlotte.org. And the 2015 Wells Fargo